Welcome to Church Drunk, a spirited conversation about faith, reason, and libations. Woo! We are wrapping up our season that started in Lent and is finishing in Easter.
Yes.
And we're going to visit our book that's all about, like, darkness and daylight and
paradox-ish
expectations. So we are going to be wrapping things up with you. And before we get there, as always, a couple of brief announcements.
Heads up.
We can be perhaps a bit potty-mouthed from time to time, perhaps a bit blasphemous from time to time, but that's just kind of our jam.
You've been warned.
Yeah, so hopefully that's your jam too, and we're Catholic. You don't have to be. As always, I am guest here with my co-host Dizzy, and
yes.
Diz, what are you drinking?
I am drinking what is essentially a Tom Collins named for Saint Peregrine.
Yes.
Who apparently in Italian is San Pellegrino.
Yeah, San Pellegrino.
I don't know how they changed, like, the spelling. Like, why isn't he Peregrino? But whatever. So he's
right.
Pellegrino. And as you said, it's kind of a Tom Collins with, like, frosting. So there's powdered sugar and extra lemon.
I think that goes into Tom Collins. I think Tom Collins.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
okay.
It's like. I've never made a Tom Collins before. So
new to us.
Yeah.
But it's gin.
Yeah.
It is a San Pellegrino that was lemon flavored.
Right. So normally it would go lemon juice and then Pellegrino water. And that's kind of how they made the spin on it for Saint Peregrine. I keep wanting to say Saint Pellegrine and then that would be wrong.
It's just all confusing. But he's the same guy.
And so we went with the Limonata Pellegrino. Pellegrino.
Damn
it. God, this is going to mess me up.
St. Peregrine's Pellegrino. Anyway, it's mostly what I normally drink. It's a clear alcohol with something bubbly, something fruity, something sweet. But it's quite refreshing and makes me look ahead to summer, so I could recommend it.
Yeah.
How about you? What are you sipping?
I'm having some brandy.
Why?
Mine's not an actual Christian Brothers brandy, but in honor of the Christian Brothers, I'm having a brandy.
Okay.
Because as we looked through our Drinking with the Saints book,
Michael P. Foley.
We found out as we were kind of thumbing through the days around when we would be recording that May 15th is kind of a big day for Michael P. Foley and Drinking with the Saints. There were, four different saints?
He had a whole bunch of choices for us today.
There were seven Spanish martyrs, and he recommended a bloody bishop, which is a Bloody Mary with sherry, which sounds delightful. There was the Pellegrino and there was another Pellegrino beverage
that we wanted to make, but just didn't have the right ingredients.
It was with Campari and Arancciata, which was nice.
And maybe orange rind or something in there too.
Yeah. And then there was this one, as well, that was the, Christian Brothers brandy on account of Saint Jean-Baptiste de La Salle, who, founded the Christian Brothers, monastic order, for those of you that aren't in the know. And they ended up founding a monastery in Napa where they had a winery. And in 1935, when Prohibition was repealed, they started making commercial wine and commercial brandy. So the Christian Brothers, I always kind of assumed that Christian Brothers was sort of like a faux spinoff of
some sort.
Right,
because people sort of know that, like, you know, old ancient monasteries, like, made alcohol, made booziness. So we just thought it was like a shout out, like a cool thing to label your brandy as Christian Brothers. But
Made the connection to the fact that there is an order of monks who go by the Christian Brothers.
They might have had like a copyright issue had that not been the case.
Like in Napa. And they started making their own brandy and commercial wine. And that actually, some argue, is sort of the spark that lit up the whole wine country explosion in Napa.
In California.
Yeah, back in the 30s. So it dates back further than, I don't know, like 70s when they were winning wine competitions or something like that.
It just goes
to show
that. It's
been a while since I watched Bottle Shock.
The church's alcoholic roots run deep and wide.
For
and
sure.
If you've enjoying some Christian Brothers brandy, that's a holy thing to do.
Yeah.
So shout out to them. And just May 15th was random, so kind of a quince de mayo, you were saying on that.
Yeah, quince de mayo. Lots of good beverages that are offered with Drinking with the Saints. So.
Sure.
And,
A glass of something strong because we are going to wrap up.
Quite frankly, we needed some good beverages to get us through today's episode, end of the season.
You know,
actually, I don't want to be too harsh.
No, we need to be balanced in our appraisal here because we may have been judging on a harder scale. Like I told you, I was comparing this book to Nouwen's The Way of the Heart, which that's a tough comparison for most books, I have to say, especially for me personally.
Yes.
Like, but we're bookish folk.
We are.
And we just really like what we like. And sometimes we have high expectations. Yeah. And if they don't quite meet them, we get a little negative. So we're trying not to be super negative. We're trying to be a fair what worked for us.
Yes.
And what didn't.
So to go back book. And kind of rehash a bit, for those of you that maybe weren't following along episode by episode for our season here. And shame on you.
Did you read the book?
But we decided to pick a book for Lent. And it spilled over into Easter time, as our podcast season also tends to do, go from Lent into Easter or Advent into Christmas. But we picked for this Lent and Easter Between the Dark and the Daylight by Sister Joan Chittister. We had some fun trying to get that name pronunciation Chittister. Down first time. Yeah. And it's a book, it's the subtitle is Embracing the Contradictions of Life.
Right.
And which makes sense for Lent, you know, darkness into light and, you know, like the promise of the resurrection, but you got to go through Good Friday. That was where our kind of intentions were.
And I always feel like church trunk is a place for paradox.
Yeah.
You know, like that's something we talk about a lot and grapple with a lot.
And it's very much part of our spirituality.
Yeah. You know, like that's what appealed to me. I had read a book by Sister Joan Chittister many years ago that was much more of like her personal spiritual journey that I didn't like. You know, I don't even remember the title. Like, I didn't love it, didn't hate it, but, like, I thought it was good enough. And so when I learned that she had this book, I was like, oh, well, we wanted something for Lent. This seems Lent-y.
Yeah. And I will say I do enjoy her, like, her prose. Like, she's a good writer. I enjoyed, you know, like, it's an easy one to kind of move through from chapter to chapter because it's neither too dense nor is it, you know, like, vapid, for lack of a better term.
Her like, writer skills make you feel like you're in good hands.
Yeah.
Which is also setting us up a bit.
Right.
Because we don't always like what she's not saying with it. Like, I felt like, in general, I wanted her to do more.
Yeah.
And the structure of the book doesn't really allow for that. Because they're really short, like 2 to 3 page. Some of them have maybe 4 or 5 page sides.
Yeah. And we sort of checked in, like, late Lent as far as, like, what our progress was. And we said, well, you know, it seems like kind of what we were hoping for was a book that we could read through and get like an idea of how to embrace the contradictions of life, sort of with a chapter by chapter going deeper and deeper. But what it really is more of like a book of sort of short meditations, like daily reflection style.
Yeah.
Actually, it's almost like they work in couplets, right? Because she has these titles that are, you know, The Delusion of Frustration, and then the next chapter would be like The Frustration of Delusion, right? So it's like they kind of work together in tandem for sets of topics that she covers.
Right. And, you know, some of them speak to me more than others. And so I read the first few at the beginning of Lent and then sort of petered out on it and kind of decided to pick and choose just by chapter title sometimes and then maybe read the one after it as well.
I think at one point I sent you, or no, maybe we watched it together. The scene from that movie Mystery Men.
Yes.
I was like, Diz, I'm having trouble getting through this book because reminds me so much of Mystery Men, which is this really obscure movie with like Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo and the guy, Pee Wee Herman, Paul Rubens. And they all play these like sort of B-list superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Paul Rubens' character is called the Spleen and his superpower is to fart on command. Janine Garofalo's the Bowler. She throws bowling balls.
On the nose
A special bowling ball.
Oh, okay.
And so they go to this, like, wise, mysterious master to, like, learn the ways of the superhero. And he has all these very formulaic sayings. And at one point he goes to Ben Stiller and he says, unless you learn to control your rage, and he cuts him off. He's like, my rage will become my master. That's what you were going to say, wasn't it? That's what you were going to say. Am I the only one that sees that things are a little formulaic here? If you want to go left, you got to go right. If you want to go up, you got to go down. So that's where I was at with this book about halfway through it. I was just kind of like, I really feel like I can predict where things are headed.
And then they go there.
And then they go there, but at the same time, like, I don't disagree with a lot of what she said in that
we just wanted more
directions. Yeah, you know, so it's like, you know, the delusion of frustration. Like, I get it. Like, getting caught up, getting wrapped up in your own frustration will be nothing good. And when you really try to untangle that mess, you'll find out that the only thing that was frustrating was the frustration itself, right? So parse through that. But then from there, once you're there, like, give me more, right?
Yeah, and some, you know, and that's kind of the risk of some of these like formulaic phrases or just quoting some other spiritual master and then not really delving into it is that it just sort of feels like just jar you out of your rut. And if that's all it's meant to do, and you haven't read a lot of other things,
yeah.
or you just read a little snippet at a time, I think it could do that. If that's the goal, it's like yeah. kind of jar you out of your thinking, right? Like to make you think paradoxically.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of the thought that to think paradoxically should take you deeper.
Yeah.
I would like the spiral to circle another half round
yeah.
to take me somewhere beyond just out of my rut, but to actually have a new realization.
Yeah. I think that's what we search for. But at the same time, like you said, you know, using it as a daily reflection or something like that,
yeah.
I could see, you know, waking up in the morning, grabbing it, picking it up and,
yeah.
and reading a chapter and saying, okay, so like today I will not allow whatever it is that Sister Joan Chittister is kind of writing about. To be my roadblock, you know,
right.
like I'm going to let go of this. I'm going to actively try. And that could be like, you know, if you did it chapter by chapter, it would be what about a month's worth of, sort of spiritual practice. So I could kind of see that working.
Okay. Well, let's pick a couple things from the reading. Like
okay.
assuming, you know, let's just pretend our dear listener didn't read the whole book.
Yeah.
Let's pick something that you think might be useful.
Well, you had a good run of like, what was it? Chapter 14, 15, 16.
I liked,
you had like
yeah.
commentary on
well,
not necessarily
what,
pros and cons, but.
Right. Cause I liked their chapter titles more than others. This is where I picked it. So 14.
So you
is,
can't read a book by its cover, but you can read a chapter by its cover.
Well, when you read the first few chapters and don't feel like reading a total of 32 of them,
yeah.
you start picking by names. So I did pick to start The Struggle Between Guilt and Growth
mm-hmm.
and The Creativity of Confusion. Actually, I started with The Sanity of Irrationality.
Yeah.
I don't know why. This book was written in 20...
I couldn't possibly think of a reason.
It was written in 2015, and I literally thought, like, I wonder how she would change that if she wrote it after, you know, November 2016.
Totally.
So, The Sanity of Irrationality was the first one, and she talks a lot about thinking.
Yeah.
And she's kind of focused on thinking as, like, trying to find the right way. And I like this chapter because it does sort of start with her saying that her mother always said to her, Joan, think.
Think, yeah.
And I was like,
part.
Oh,
yeah.
like that's true. We all do have these lines in our heads from our parents or mentors or whatever that we tell ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Like she says the point where she put it on her screensaver. And that's all kind of stuff that I believe in. I'm
yeah.
like, yeah, like think.
Totally.
Right? Like Dizzy, you should just stop and think for a moment.
For sure.
You know,
yeah.
take yourself out of it a little bit. But she's more focused on like how thinking can lead you to feeling there's only one right or wrong answer.
Yeah.
And I think her point in this is to point out that it doesn't have to be, you know, polar things that you're choosing between.
Right.
I did take umbrage a little bit because I think thinking doesn't have to lead you. That's what I wrote in the margin.
Yeah.
It doesn't guarantee, like thinking for me doesn't guarantee rightness or wrongness. I'm
right.
hoping it just leads to a better choice or
yeah.
a more informed choice. But she did at one point say, and this is a quote I liked, so I'm trying to be fair here. She said that I found out that one bad decision is often more enlightening than what the quote-unquote right one would have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like she and I got to the same conclusion by different means.
Yeah.
Because she's saying she had to let go or accept that she'd make a bad decision. And I'm thinking, well, there's not a bad decision if you thought about it. You
yeah.
made the best that you could. That's out of your control.
Right.
So maybe it's more of an issue with process because I often agree with her conclusion.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment. I think that like I would get hung up on her language sometimes in terms
mm-hmm.
of the way that she would interpret a word, and I would look at it and say, but that doesn't necessarily mean that in my experience.
Yeah.
And she would probably say the same thing, but it would take her, you know, the whole chapter to arrive at
yeah.
why she doesn't feel that way. So in some ways, she was trying to lay out arguments that were, in my opinion, or maybe more in my experience, like self-evident, right? Like I've already kind of walked that walk and I've kind of figured that out
yeah.
for myself. And so reading the book about like, here's the pathway to get you there for me was a little frustrating at times,
mm-hmm.
but we both agree that like for others and especially like for young people, probably this
yeah.
would be a good book. Like for, you know, like high school age kids that are really trying to parse through some of that
it's
stuff.
It's very
like junior
approachable
high,
language.
Might be able to get something out of it. Yeah.
And when you saying that makes me think like part of our hang up with it might be wordsmithery
mm-hmm.
because we sort of default to precision of language. We're like,
right.
well, you picked this word, like don't go and reduce
yes.
that word or change that word. Like we understand what that word means and,
right.
and what it means stands on its own. And she does write very colloquially and
yeah.
is going to walk you through it in a gentle way. So maybe part of it's just
yeah.
that like
well,
language.
But they're also like, I got, not necessarily like, I don't think it was a bad approach, but I think the repetition of the approach where it's like, let's take something that we
mm-hmm.
automatically think of as bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Irrationality. and then let's figure out how to make it good, you know? And it's like, well, yeah, like anything, yeah. like, like too much rationality, of course, is bad. And, but like not enough of it's like, it's this sliding scale, right? And it's always yeah. going to be situational. And she was really trying to like kind of jolt people out yeah. of thinking things as just one or the other.
Right. And but we're like, thinking doesn't just mean right or wrong. But thinking means being creative, right. being open.
Like, but she was doing it also by yeah. like, by picking the opposite, right? So it's like, you think irrationality is bad, but it's actually the sane. Only sane way to go. And I'm like, no, you just made a crazy statement. Like that.
You're like think, Joan.
I could write a counter chapter that says the sanity of rationality, right? You know, like, so
yeah,
there was a counterpoint to everything that she was saying. And I, you know, like, if yeah. God knows if there's a counterpoint to be made, I love to make it. So I think maybe that's part of my hang up with the book as well.
Okay.
I think we're talking ourselves through like group therapy for what happened with this book right now.
I think we really wanted to like it.
Yeah.
And
there were parts. It had
But you know, there's something good to be said then as something that challenges us mm-hmm. to be okay with a different style yeah. or a different process. But so
I think you called it out last time when we were talking about the book, sort of the mid-Lent check-in or whatever, that like there's all in almost every chapter. Yeah. I say almost because there were a few that as I went through it, because I did not choose to cherry pick my chapters. I plowed through
Glutton for Punishment, this guest.
And there were times where I was like, nope, Dizzy was wrong. There is nothing redeeming about this chapter. But for the most part,
okay.
almost every single chapter has at least a few lines, if not more, that okay. you can say, like, that's good. That's a beautiful statement. I agree with that. That's
Let's
a lovely
just take that. Yeah, yeah sure. So,
and that, again, that brings me back to, like, I do like her writing
yeah.
style.
Do you have one that you want to highlight?
Well, I did like chapter 29, okay. The Certitude of Doubt.
I did not read that.
Yeah, well...
So obviously. I'm glad that I get to hear about it from you.
I think I liked it in that, you know, like I said, she lays out why something that we normally would think of as bad, doubt,
mm-hmm.
Is actually something that we should be okay with. In fact, we should be more comfortable with doubt than we are. And that's like in my theological books, I tend to really enjoy the moments where I can get like a fist pump and go, yeah, like right on. Like I should like the things that challenge me more, right? I don't necessarily pre-agree with them. But this one, I definitely pre-agreed with what she was going for.
So if you had been picking chapter titles, you might have chosen this one.
I might
one.
Have chosen now, yeah.
Okay.
Because it's, you know, like she quotes Voltaire saying, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is absurd. So if you have the choice between... you know, being 100% certain. And when you apply that to faith, right,
mm-hmm.
we have to be 100% certain that God exists if we're going to be people of faith. Well, as soon as you have 100% certainty about God, you've got the wrong image of God in mind. Like,
right.
it's shrouded in mystery, you know? Like, I'm a cloud of unknowing kind of guy when it comes to God. So doubt is built into faith, and it's a comfortable place
to
be.
That.
For me, but it's not comfortable for everybody, and that's why instead they choose certainty, which is absurd. And so, you know, like that building of the argument was one where I said, yes, like this is somebody putting better words than I ever could
mm-hmm.
to something that I believe.
Yeah, you could feel the truth in that.
Yeah.
I think she was kind of stronger towards the end, because yeah. while I didn't read that chapter, that was one of the later chapters,
yeah.
and I read maybe the last two or three, and she kind of continues with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I also appreciated, she talked about the Bible story of the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
And kind of had this, and this section I really liked, because she says when she was a little kid, she heard that story and like just didn't get it. I was like, why would God like mess up their plans? They were trying to get closer to right. God by building this tower. And instead of like honoring that, God is like, let me just spread you guys out and make it harder to talk to each other, because
yeah.
you are trying to make me into one thing
right.
instead of realizing that I am present with all of you all the time. And that's really the work of life, is to attend to that presence. And yeah. I was like, this feels very
right.
Profound to me, and a good reminder. Like, I would like to read that more than once and
yeah.
to kind of sit with that thought. So I thought that was one of the more beautiful parts.
Yeah.
of the spirituality of this book, you know, that God is with us always. And, like, that's a very simple idea, but obviously one that humanity wrestles with. And she kind of talks about all the different labels and how the different religions of the world for the first time are interacting. And we're seeing that it's
yeah.
not like they're gobbling each other up. It's that they're actually, in some parts of the world at least, becoming more comfortable engaging in each other's practices
yeah.
and this kind of idea that God is present in all these different traditions mm-hmm. in different ways. So I liked that bit.
She strikes me as, you know, just in reading this only, you know, I hadn't read her previously. So reading this one little bit that I grappled with, she does strike me as somebody who would make a really good, like, spiritual advisor, you know, mm-hmm. like, if you were to sit with her and have her sort of coach you through.
Yes.
Just sort of where you're at in life, right? Like, because a lot of times when people go to those, like, spiritual directors or something yeah. like that, it comes from a place of, like, I'm struggling with something, right? Right. So, like, I have a lot of anger or a lot of fear. And she could say, well, you know, there's really a fearlessness to fear, isn't there? And you would go, oh my God, you know,
there's a courage and yeah. a cowardice.
Right, yeah. But she yes. would be able to kind of coach you through some of that stuff in a way that really totally. Is very, like, eye-opening and very frank and very honest.
And she's got the depth of, like, knowledge in that time. Like, she, you can tell that she's done the hard work.
Right, right. But when it just, and I think maybe it's a like a formatting or editing issue with this book yeah. combined with our expectations, because it came across to me like almost like the equivalent of like scrolling through like quoteland.com, you know?
Yes.
Like, just kind of like.
Every chapter, though, had quotes from other people. Right. They're only 2 pages long.
You get these snippets and it's like, no, but like take that, unravel it, explore it yeah. more. And that's what we were looking for. Right. But it's not necessarily what the intention was with the book itself.
And as we're saying this, maybe it's because we're fully capable of making up right. these lovely statements on our own. Like, listen, we don't need your help to like rattle off quotes and like nicely tie them up together. We need somebody to be like, no, motherfucker, you need to go a little deeper.
Which is also probably why we would be really bad sitting down with Sister Joan Chittister as our spiritual advisor, because she'd be like, there's a fearlessness to fear, isn't there? And we'd be like, ah, that's bullshit. Come on, give me something real.
Come on, Sister Joan. Think, Joan. Think. Poor Sister Joan. You know what? We are, like, nowhere near her level. And just
but
like,
I think we both read it and kind of realized, like, yeah. it is useful, but wasn't really for us
I just don't think it matched up with where we are on our
I was surprised at one point as I was going through it at how little of it actually, like, it all relates to God and spirituality mm-hmm. if you read it that way. But very rarely does she actually, like, mention it. And I think that's part of what I was missing. Like, she doesn't necessarily drive home, like, where does this put you with God? Or how does this tie you into the mystery of God?
Yeah.
Or how does this connect you with God? So it didn't, you know, it read more like self-help reading to me than like spiritual reading. And I think I found myself kind of being like, well, if this is my Lent, like, I want to be
maybe we picked the wrong season for it.
Yeah.
But that's funny that you say that, because every section that I like liked and highlighted is something maybe a little more theologically dense than others. Like, I have the section where she talks about an ancient church explanation of sin that's called the happy fault. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yes, let's get our philosophical shoes on and go for a walk. Like, you know, that's the kind of thing that appealed to me too.
Yeah. And then we hit the chat. Like, so you, like I said, I think you highlighted 14, 15, 16, the sanity of irrationality. You really
the struggle
liked.
Between guilt and growth. Because this one talks about shame, and I am a personal believer in shame. I'll just go out there and say it. I think shame is good for you. And this chapter does highlight that there's like more than one kind of shame. And she's like, I don't mean the soul eating emotion, the kind that makes you like what Jung speaks about. She said instead, she means the kind, and this is quoting Lewis Cronenberger, somebody else in the same chapter, same paragraph quoted.
Yeah.
One of the misfortunes of our time is that in getting rid of false shame, we have killed off so much of real shame as well. And I'm like, I totally believe that, you know, shame is what makes you become better and become more moral when you actually feel bad about something and don't want to be like that anymore.
Totally.
And not the kind that makes you want to, like, hurt yourself, but the kind that makes you want to improve yourself.
Right, yeah.
So that was chapter 14.
I think that, you know, like, that reflects, like, what probably for you was a long, lifelong journey, you know, to get to that point, or at least at the point that you made that realization.
Yeah.
You know, like, all of your experiences had built that up for you. And you and I have had similar experiences that give us a similar perspective on that, right?
Sure.
Like, if you don't like where you're at, then get better.
Yeah. Like, good, sit with that, and that will help you.
Crying about it. But I'll give you something to cry about.
Crying doesn't help, okay?
But I also think that, you know, there are a lot of people out there who you know, they for one reason or another, and for oftentimes, you know, circumstances outside of their control, they do get stuck with those things. You know, they yes. kind of end up trapped in that moment right. and unable to move past it. And whether it's guilt or whether it's shame or whether it's a sense of
defeat,
lack of a self-esteem or something right. You know, like all those things can kind of pile up on top of people, and oftentimes you can trace it to just one thing, right? And if that's where you're at and you read this whole book, but there's just the one chapter that speaks to your thing, then all of a sudden I would guess that you would fall in love with the book, right? You'd be like, oh my gosh, like this has unlocked so much for me.
Yeah, and you know, if one phrase is something that gives you more to think about,
mm-hmm.
then that's a valuable thing. I think part of the issue is we didn't find anything terribly new to think about.
Yeah.
I was talking to you earlier and I said it's an unfair comparison to the Lent book last year, which was The Way of the Heart by Nouwen. And what really hooked me on that book is that he would start at about the level where this Chittister book is. Like, right, he'd say something and you'd be like, oh, but, yeah, and you could think of like your but. And then the next segment, he'd be like, and when you're thinking that, here's what I really mean. You're like, oh, yeah, he like got me, you know?
Drove it home, yeah.
And that is kind of what I really revel in. Like, that was challenging to me and like really feeding of my spirituality. Yeah. So, not like we're super far along the path, but I think we just like a little bit more.
Yeah, and there is a bit of that, you know, drop the mic moment in the last couple chapters, as you said, you know, mm-hmm. like she kind of expands the view beyond just like one issue at a time and starts to try and finish on kind of a high note to encourage. And so there's that little bit of like, okay, so we've looked at all of these different issues. We've kind of picked something up that we thought was a negative and we've looked at the underside of it and said, oh, there's a positive to be found there. And then she starts to wrap it up and try to end on a really hopeful note for where you go from here. So there is, but it's not, you know, like we need mic drops along the way, you know, not just one little one at the end.
Right.
I think it was supposed to be a big one, but for us it was a little one.
It was a littler one, but I could recommend the book. Like we said, if you are somebody who would like a lighter read in general and a shorter sections, I mean, I think it is a good starting place. I could say that.
It's a good daily reader for, you know.
Like, and it is hopeful. And I think it would, like, not that that's the goal, but, like, make you feel good or give you something positive to ponder.
For sure.
Especially if you're struggling.
Yeah. But if you're used to and into, like, denser theological reads, this is one that's going to make you feel like you made
probably
white bread mayo sandwich.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like, some people like that, but it's not a bad book. It's just not what we expected, I think, in the end.
So that was our foray into between daylight and darkness and daylight.
I think I do want to read something else by Sister Joan because you had a good experience, and then this one you were kind of like, hey, it wasn't my favorite, so I do want to read some of her other stuff. She gets like big time thumbs up from
people like
Jim
Martin. We might have just picked the wrong book.
Yeah, like I'm looking at the people that recommend it, and I'm like, no, these are like Richard Rohr, James Martin, like these are people that we really respect their opinions, and they like her. So I want to read more from her and just kind of continue. So at the very least, there's that. It whet my appetite for a little more Chittister in my life.
Guess hasn't written her off forever.
It's just too fun of a name to say to not continue down that path.
Okay.
But before we wrap up the season, we are currently recording on Sunday.
It's the 19th.
6:53 local time, which means that there is one question remaining, hanging in the air.
What's that?
Who wins the Game of Thrones?
I know. You either win or you die. Yeah.
So, those of you that have not watched the show but are interested in watching Game of Thrones, we'll drop a little spoiler alert here. We're not going to have a whole conversation about it, but if you're interested in the show, turn us off now. so, I would ask who...
Oh, prediction time.
Closing shot, who's going to be sitting on the Iron Throne. But really, you got to go back and go, is there even an Iron Throne anymore? Because it wasn't just King's Landing that got torched. Like, the Red Keep got trashed.
Red Keep fell.
Like, is there an Iron Throne to be had?
I mean, it's iron. I don't know that it would... Although
melt
it seemed
under
like,
dragonfire?
It seems like...
That's how the swords got put there in first place.
Drogon was melting everything.
Everything got melted.
And you know what? And I'm kind of fine with the Iron Throne. That shit was ugly.
Right.
Nothing good was happening there. I'm okay with it.
So instead of who sits on the Iron Throne, which was literally what people were asking for years now.
All of the Seven Kingdoms.
Who wins the Game of Thrones in the end?
I don't know. So here's the thing. If we're going with a traditional fantasy story, my answer would be different because it's not George R. R. Martin writing this. It's right. the HBO people, which just makes me hesitate. Like, I kind of feel like if it was George, there might be nobody on the throne.
Yeah.
It all might push a reset. We all might be in some little snowy piece of a dragon's eye. Like, I don't know. Like, like, it might be like...
like the Game of Thrones yes. equivalent of, like, Horton Hears a Who. Like,
exactly.
You pull back.
Exactly. You pull back.
And the whole kingdom just existed on a snowflake.
Right. Exactly. Like, I think that could be where it's like you wake up and it's all reset. I don't know.
Interesting.
I can't say. I think with HBO, though, I think they've laid it out for us. I don't think it's going to be a surprise. I think... Danny will get vanquished by, like, the Stark Empire, whether that's Jon or Arya or Sansa in, like, Holy Trinity with Bran, like, representing whatever Bran represents now.
Yeah, whatever the hell Bran
is. I don't know, like...
Interesting.
I don't think Jon will keep it. Maybe it'll be the girls. Maybe it'll be Arya and Sansa.
Yeah.
Although Sansa's never coming south.
Well, that's it. I think
it's blown up.
I think Danny keeps it, and then there's a, like, the whole thing ends up being, like, the forthcoming war between, like, Sansa, basically, and Danny.
They're going to leave it hanging? There's no more seasons
Not even
this.
Leave it hanging. They're just going to be like, there is nothing but war. Like,
are they going to, like, Lost this on us where there's no answer?
Yeah, well, no, I think Danny takes back the throne, which she has done, right? Like, she wins the Game of Thrones, but then, like, the real message is there is no winner in the Game of Thrones because there's just going to be more war. Like, we're not going to show it to you, but there's war, and then after that, there's war, and then after that, there's war.
Okay.
That's my thought.
That's a good thought. I still kind of feel like since they decided to let her go Mad Queen, she's going to die. I feel like it'll just be a repush of all the old stuff.
Could be.
Who knows?
Well... we'll leave you with that, and then by the time that we post this, you'll know how wrong we are.
It'll be, you know what? It'll be Pentecost, and we will be drinking some sort of dragon fire cocktail.
Yeah.
How about that?
So thus
Let
ends,
them come together.
Right. Season whatever this is.
Okay,
of,
wait. Do you want to say your... So your prediction is Danny sits the throne.
Danny sits the throne, and there's just war.
And I'm going to say some Stark sits the throne.
Some Stark.
All right.
All right. Well...
happy...
here's to being wrong.
Cheer.
We are ending our season, and we'll be back in a few weeks, though, with a bonus episode, probably, that's something Pentecostal-y.
Dragon-costal. It's a new holiday. We're into that now.
Dragon-cost.
See?
So we thank you for listening for the season or the episode, or however long you have been along for the ride. And we'll be back in a few weeks.
And we'd love to hear from you in the meantime if we should do a summer session. And if we do, any books you might like highlighted or things to talk about, you can email us at churchdrunk@gmail.com or tweet, I guess.
At churchdrunkpod.
And we will see you sometime back here at Church Drunk.
Where
the
I don't know. Dizzy had something for this, but I'm not.
No, I didn't have something for this, but I was gonna say, like, the courage isn't the cowardice. I needed a formula. Here at Church Drunk.
Where you cannot sit on the Iron Throne until the Iron Throne sits on you.
That was it!